So as I was down there doing my first few consults, so very nice fellow, and I didn't look at his face. So I hope I'm not embarrassing you. No need to be embarrassed. But he was carrying a very large chair over his head, which led me to believe this is not a person on whose bad side I want to be, because he could probably just, you know, pick me up and throw me over the other side of the Kotel or something. But someone said to him, "What's he talking about?" And he said, "It doesn't matter. The Q&A is the fun part." So I'll start with my Dvar Torah. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, let's get to the questions. Okay. Let me explain to you why I always start with a little Dvar Torah thing. That is only because this is the same when you sit down with Chasanim and Kalas. You know, like when a boy in my shul brings a girl for the first time, I know she's terrified. You know, "I'm taking you to meet the rabbi." "Oh, no, please, not that. Anything but that. Oh, God, he's so big and scary. Oh, my." Pardon me, it's just a little teeny-weeny touch of schizophrenia. No big deal. God, I wish I remember which suitcase I put my meds in. Oh, boy. Anyway, so the first, I never, like talk about the heavy stuff the first time. We just sort of talk about, like, you know, I don't know, what kind of flowers the flower girls should have and things like that. Just light things. And this only so they can get used to my voice and being around so that they can relax. And then when we have to talk about things that are more substantive, that they can feel, you know, relaxed. So for the sake of the fellows that I haven't yet had the chance to meet, so I always start off with a little, you know, sort of patter, I guess, a little Dvar Torah. But that, oh, this is embarrassing. You have to be quiet now. Oh, never mind, it's just a text message. I don't have to talk to them. Louder? I have all these microphones. How come none of them actually does anything about making my voice loud? No, it just broadcasts it so that by the time I get off the plane, my son will be asking me about all the jokes that I told this time. That's what they do, my children. Tough bunch. Tough, tough. You were better last year, Tati. For the sake of the most important thing is, it's like, I don't want anybody to be, like, nervous. So that if you have, when we do get to the questions, and the questions will come in two shlavim. One will be, you can ask anything you want here. And second, I will try to stay as late as my body will allow me. If there's anyone who, for whatever reason, has something they want to discuss that's personal, I can't make an absolute promise because there have been years where, like, by 3:30 or 4, I just couldn't do anymore. But I will really try to stay here. Maybe nobody wants to, but I will sit here until the last guy has had a chance, because not that I have any special, I don't have anything special to offer except very serious listening. So that's a commitment. So the questions can come in two shapes. So let's quickly get through the Dvar Torah, because as that guy said, who cares what he talks about? The main thing is get to the Q&A. Just a very important Hanukkah concept before we get to Hanukkah. The Hanukkah miracle is, it would seem, the most diminutive miracle in all the holiday cycle. You compare it to the big ones, it's absolutely a midget. You know, like some fancy oil. You know, like Yaha. I mean, honestly, like compared to Kriyas Yamsuf. You know. But that is because with the miracle of Hanukkah, we actually have the last flickering of the miraculous as the signature of the Almighty, the presence of God. It is no accident that Chanukah is also considered the festival of Torah Shebaal Peh. And it's important to understand what Torah Shebaal Peh means. Of course, the part of it is because the Tanaitic period really begins from the Hasmonean period toward the end of this of the second Beis Hamikdash. And the miracle of Chanukah is the symbol of the transition into the new era. What is the new era? The new era is about the relationship between the Jew and the wisdom of the Torah. The Jew, because he is the descendant of the Avos. You know, when Rashi defines the concept of chinuch, he's defining the word chanichav, when Avraham goes to make the war, take his place in the war of the four kings against the five kings, Rashi describes the meaning of the word chinuch as the dedication of something to its true ultimate purpose. And that can be an object, it can be a person. That's what Chanukas HaMizbeach means, the dedication of the Mizbeach to its purpose as a link between our world and Shamayim. A Jew, by virtue of being a descendant of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, a Jew is a kli. What does a kli mean? A kli means an object with a potential for utility. In other words, when you forge a hammer, when you forge a saw, you don't have a building. But what you have is an implement capable of bringing building about, of making a process. You now have potential. Right? The other thing that exists in the world, which for us is the core of wisdom, and here Rav Huttner brings two things into parallel, which are really, it's really quite interesting. This is just one of those, there are certain factoids, it just pays to keep them handy at all times, because they could be useful in very many contexts. And I guess it was the Maharal who taught us to pay attention to numbers. So we know from Pirkei Avos that the world was created in 10 utterances, right? Asar Ma'amaros Nivra Olam. We know that the relationship between the Ribbono Shel Olam and Klal Yisrael as a relationship of Torah begins with Aseres Hadibros. So what Rav Huttner Zal points out is that there are two parallel testaments, which is true. There is the testament of creation. The world speaks, if you know how to look at it, the world speaks of its creator. Every bird's song, every flower's fragrance is in essence a kind of Tehillim, declaring that there is a Borei Olam, that all of this comes from a benevolent creator. On the other hand, the Aseres Hadibros, which speak in a much more specific way to God's formula for us to live by, his will, but his will made very articulate, is its power, is its parallel. So the Jews are the heir to this second form, to this pure nectar, if you will, already refined, of Hashem's will. The world of the Greeks is a world which worships Chochmas HaTeva. It's a world which is not actually antithetical, but it rather comes from the less direct evidence of God, namely the evidence in the world of nature, of which philosophy was really a servant. And the Jew represents the world in its God in the world, the wisdom of life, in a different, more articulate, distilled form in the language of the Torah. When the Greeks, according to the Midrash, commanded the Jews, Kisfu lachem al keren shor, you must write on the horn of an ox, Ein lachem chelek be'elohei Yisrael, you have no portion in God. What they really meant was, you have to renounce your special relationship with that second ten, with the ten which trumps our ten. You have to stop pretending that God spoke to you, and you have to play by the rules that cover everyone else. You have to figure it out on your own from the forests and the streams. And the response of the Jew is, we refuse to make that statement. And we can prove it. We can prove that it is still true. Why? Because we will take the Torah, which is, if you will, fuel, and we will absorb it in ourselves, and we will be the vessel. How are we a vessel? We are vessels by virtue of being the children of the Avos. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided to pour the Torah into the world, it was not Toras Avram Avinu, it was Toras Moshe Rabbeinu. But where was the only place he could put it? The only place he could put it was in this vessel, which was the children of the Avos. They were the only ones who could be Klei Kibul, who could hold it properly. And when he would add it to them, when that vessel and that fuel would be brought together, there would be a kind of evidence of the rightness of that joining, and that would be a kind of a combustion, a light, a flame. That flame is the point of ignition, conflagration in every generation between the Masorah of the Torah and Klal Yisrael. And when those things come together, what do they produce? They produce Torah Shebaal Peh. They produce another chapter of the great organic living thing, which is our living Torah, not just the text, but the adumbration of that text. I mean, as I pointed out before, I mean, it is so, when you think about it, it is so moving. You are here in this Yerushalayim, in your lifetime, just as examples, Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and more recently, Rabbi Avadia Yosef, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. They walked these streets. Amish walked the same street. They walked to the same kotel that you walked. They were children in this city. Shlomo Zalman was raised in Shari Chesed. Rabbi Avadia went to yeshiva at Parat Yosef, right next door to you. They came in the same way you came into this building, as kelim. And they filled themselves up. And the reaction, the combustion, was the Torah that they created. No one will ever study how electricity functions in halacha without referring to Rosh Hashanah Zalman. The Abiya Omer will have to be part of the discussion in any significant Torah psak that Rav Avadia touched, and there's almost nothing that he didn't touch. They began as a kli, they received what was there before, the oil, something new and bright and miraculous sprang up, and by the next generation, that's now part of the oil that will be poured in, please God, to each of you as you become a kli by virtue of the fact that you are among the stars that Avraham Avinu looked at in the sky when Hashem said, Ko yeh zarecha. There was a star for each one of you. And when the day came for your neshama to be sent to the world, you were one of those remarkable kelim that had the possibility of receiving the Torah and of bursting into the flame of Chiddush, which would become part of the Torah for the next generation. One of the most profound rejections of what Yiddishkeit is. If you hear somebody say, that's the rabbis. That's not really what God, that's not God's will. That's just the rabbis. Some rabbis threw that in. They missed the boat. Because those additions came about through that unique nexus of what began as a gift from Sinai, the Aseres Hadibros, and the Bnei Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And what we call the tradition of the rabbis, of the Talmidei Chachamim of each generation, to which you are invited to join, well, in each generation, that is the miracle. We don't need Kriyas Yamsuf. We don't even need any funny oil coming out of the Beis HaMikdash. That's just a symbol of where to go looking for the real miracle. The miracle of Hischadshus HaTorah, of its infinite renewability, of its affirmation that it will bring light only when it comes into this particular kli. You know what? That is not only a more remarkable thing than the Pach Shemen. In its way, that is a more remarkable thing than Kriyas Yamsuf and even than the initial Matan Torah, because it is replicable. It's replicable, and it offers every generation to be the evidence of the holiness and the dignity and the vitality which is Klal Yisrael. So in case you're down on Hanukkah thinking that, you know, they must have really run out of stuff to talk about, if, you know, the whole world is, it's like one of those, you know, those bulbs you can now get in Home Depot that, you know, like go for 25 years. They are so depressing. I hate that, a 25-year bulb. You know, I go to the hardware store. I got to start worrying about which bulbs are going to outlive me. So you guys are young, Tzalanga you are, and you'll go through a couple of those things. I'm thinking, this darn thing might be listed in my obituary. You know, survived by, you know, children, grandchildren, and 3 light bulbs. They'll fight over it in the will. Probably cause my children to hate each other and not talk to anybody. Who's getting the bulbs? Forget about it. You want Tati's books? What books? Give me a bulb. The books are going to, you know, eventually get moldy, but the bulb, that's forever. Forever. It's great. So, greatest bracha I can give you is you're in this city where so many kelim have been filled up. First start with a lot of humility. First start by venerating what that Masorah is. and you write somewhere, Yesh lanu chelek, Elohei Yisrael. We've come for our part in the deal. Okay, you've been very polite. I assume you've all gotten used to my voice. If anyone has any questions, I've been waiting 1 year. They're just going to sit there and go. They're not going to, no one's going to ask any questions. So I have put a few plants in there. No, I'm just kidding. You can ask about anything you want, by the way. You don't have to ask about Hanukkah or Masorah, but you can ask anything you want. Shust.
There was an incident this morning in Yeshiva. I guess the question is...
I can't hear you.
There was an incident this morning in Yeshiva. You probably didn't hear about that either. What was it?
What's the proper procedure when a group of Jews are walking and an Arab spits on the floor as they're walking by? What's the correct procedure?
Halacha l'maisa. Keep walking. And hope that this person will soon run into someone who will be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim. I'll tell you a funny story. It's not that funny. I mean, it's funny means weird funny. It's not funny funny. These guys are laughing already. They're going to then feel guilty afterwards because it's not that funny. But it's funny, you know what I'm saying. You know they almost blew up. There was this plot to blow up my shul. No, it wasn't me. I didn't. I prefer arson. there, you could tell it wasn't me because none of the members were inside at the time. Anyway, so these guys, and it turns out they really were recruited by the FBI, but friends of ours they weren't. So they were going to blow up the shul. Turns out they didn't blow up the shul, it's fine. But they were going there on their way to jail. So I get a call from a lady, and she tells me I am the aunt of one of the people, one of the bombers, and I wonder if I could meet you. So I happened to be, she lived near Montefiore Hospital, where I visit very often. I went to visit her. We sat down and had coffee together. And she said, I want you to know some things. And my nephew, who participated in this thing, first of all, no one in our family supports that kind of hatred. We're not hateful people. It's just we're aghast that anyone would do such a thing. But I just want the rabbi to know the context, that he has a younger brother who is suffering from liver cancer, Aleinu v'lo aleichem. He's being treated in a miserable hospital in Bedford, New York. This man is watching his brother die. And they offered him money, and he was going to use the money to try to get him better treatment, to try to save his little brother. And I want you to know that's how he got sucked into this plot. I said, give me 5 minutes. I went aside. Now, I happen to know the guy, wonderful, wonderful physician, who was the head of liver transplants at a very big New York hospital. When this guy was sitting Shiva for his father, the crown princes of Saudi Arabia were calling him to offer condolences because he had saved so many members of their family. So he's like really top, top, top guy. So I called him. I called my friend. I said, Lou, here's the case. Can you help? So this Jewish doctor, at his expense, had this young man brought down and treated in his hospital. And I told the aunt right there and then that we were going to arrange this. I said, just do me one favor. I said, tell your nephew that the people that he thought were his enemies, that we're praying for his little brother, and that he will be treated by one of the finest doctors in the country who happens to be a Jew. Kachava. This guy spits. You have no idea what he may have been subjected to in his life. I myself remember when we would stand guard in Har Etzion, at the Gush, in the 70s. And these elderly Arab workers came to work in the gardens. And the way some of the guys treated them, with such disrespect. Older people. David Tuazut. Like, rough. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, what if I were a guy and saw someone speak like that to my grandfather? What would I carry in my heart? So I'm not saying it's right. And I don't like being in the hating business. But I also don't like being drawn into the hating. So I would say in that instance, look, if someone's going to endanger a Jew, someone's going to endanger anyone, you have to protect yourself. If a guy pulled a knife on a friend of mine, I would shoot him dead without a moment's hesitation. Don't you come near my family. What you're describing is a show of insult, hatred. It's the equivalent of making an obscene gesture. I don't think I'd want to see violence or more anger spilled over that. I think I would let it go and hope to God that this man will at some point in the near future encounter the Jews and the Israelis who ran to help the people in the Philippines, who took the child of a Palestinian leader into their hospital to make her well. We'll discover that we are Rachmonim b'nei Rachmonim, and the same blood of Avraham Avinu which makes us Kalim for Kabbalah HaTorah also makes us people with an absolutely uncanny capacity for compassion and generosity. And the sooner he finds that out, the sooner he won't have to worry about people spitting in the street. So that's my advice. Yes. Tell me your name, Sadiq.
Avi Lent.
Okay. What's your father's name?
David.
The doc, the holy doctor. His father's like, I don't want to embarrass you. Your doc, your father's just such a wonderful guy. I love your father. Yeah.
Anyways, there's the
moving right along. Little awkward pause there. Yes. Let's talk some more about the old man. Yeah.
There's a case where you're on an island and you have the choice to eat from a pig or from a human. And the pig is a lotas edoraisa, and the human is a asay, maybe even a derabanan. And a lot of poskim say they should do the pig. So where do morals come in?
Famous machlokas between Rav Amital and Rav Lichtenstein. Yeah. Rav Lichtenstein goes with the guy. Rav Amital goes with the pig.
I'm saying within morals outside of Torah, where is that?
I don't know about morals outside of Torah. I don't think that Rav Amital was ever outside of Torah. I think that Rav Amital... There are always two ways. In other words, there are two methodologies in Torah. One is the methodology which gives the greater weight to the particular, and the other is a methodology which gives sometimes a greater weight to the broad concepts. So, for example, you'll see, you know, concepts like Kovod HaBrios or Mishum Eva, Midarkei Shalom, right? These are broad stroke concepts. You will find certain poskim who put a great emphasis on these, sometimes at the expense of the more particularistic things, and others who approach in a more mathematically precise methodology. Having learned with both Rav Lichtenstein, Lahavdil ben Achayim ben Amesim, Rav Mital Zal, I can absolutely pledge that each of them came to their approach through the purest Yiras Shamayim. If you want to talk about Elu ve'Elu, that is an Elu ve'Elu. Rav Aaron, if he had to, if he felt that it was the Ritzon Hashem al pi halacha, would sit down and eat human flesh and make a bracha. Out of pure Yiras Shamayim, not because he's insensitive. And Rav Amital on his side, if he had to sit down and eat chazer, knowing he was violating a lo sase, he would eat it, and he would say, "L'shem yichud kudcha barichu al shemiras tzelem elokim." He would come with exactly the same purity of heart, which is why, by the way, that they loved each other so much, even though they had slightly different views and, you know, slightly different traditions. But each one knew that the other one was coming from a place of great purity and great Yiras Shamayim. Okay? That's it. What is with this group? They got to shake them up. What's your name?
Ben.
Hey, Ben.
Do you think that democracy is a Jewish value?
Do I think that democracy is a Jewish value? Here's a question no one's ever asked before. I think that the sacredness of the individual is a Jewish value. The notion of ultimately moral responsibility being written on the tablets of the heart. Now, we are careening toward a reality in the world where individualism, individuality, individual power has never, ever been imagined in these terms. The mere fact that I walk around with a telephone number that just rings for me wherever I go. So you're just a little too young to appreciate how bizarre that is. Absolutely bizarre. Anybody here, did anyone ever read to you people as children? Did any of you ever read that greatest of all children's books, The Cow, what's it called? Good Night Moon, yes. That greatest of all. First of all, I should make you aware, as a literary critic, are you aware that that book is written in syncopated rhythm, like jazz? Are you aware of that? In the great green room, there was a telephone, dun, 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 and a picture of cow jumping over the moon, and there were three little bears sitting in chairs. I just wanted to make you aware of that. And in case you don't recognize, do you know where syncopation really comes from? This was at least the theory. Where do you get that syncopated jazz rhythm first really getting started? Right? It's typical of the Roaring Twenties. Do you know what else is typical of the Roaring Twenties? What? Who? Rory?
Rowing?
I don't know. What language is he talking? Is this English over here? I thought I spoke a pretty good English. These NYU boys, they're all, they talk funny. Very talk, funny talking. I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. But in the 20s, what was new in the world was the wide distribution, the first broad distribution of automobiles. When you hear that sound, what you are hearing is the idling engine of a Model T Ford. T.S. Eliot picked it up in The Wasteland when he said, "That oh, 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 Shakespearean rag, it's so elegant, so intelligent." See? Torah Mata, guys. Get with the program. What this concept of the autonomous individual is something which at the moment is just totally out of control, is working counter to all canons of morality, right? It's what allows people to make up a screen name and go on the internet and become crazy people, right? However, it is also the footfalls of the Mashiach, because it is beckoning toward a time when Kabbalas HaTorah will be something that every individual, or the Kabbalas Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, that every individual will be doing it, not because he is oppressed by society or because, you know, his friends won't talk to him, he'll be shunned. He will do it ach v'rak because his heart has told him that this is the Ritzon Hashem, this is what he wants to do. That is where the world is going. The Ribbono Shel'olam has not lost control. Democracy is built on the notion, in the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, which is not your document, unfortunately, in the Magna Carta, garnished. But we hold these truths to be self-evident, that every man is endowed with certain unalienable rights by his Creator. Now, it goes on to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which are not entirely clear. But the notion, unalienable rights by his Creator, the individual, democracy, true democracy, when it works, and there are problems with democracy, but true democracy works when every individual takes upon him and herself responsibility that the world should be established as a just society. Exercised that way, I do believe that democracy is part of the apotheosis of human potential. The investment of each yachid with the ability to come to a judgment of what is righteousness in the world. So ultimately, I think yes. Democracy, however, has certain problems in that democracy, you can, as a system, before you worry about the individual, you can democratically enshrine great evil and immorality. In other words, the majority can decide to persecute the minority. And technically speaking, that's democracy. But that's evil. So the Torah potential of the democracy is going to depend specifically upon the elevation of the individual to be making decisions with those standards, with the standards of righteousness and justice. Does that make sense, Ben? Okay. Thank you. Yeah. What about the back row? What are you guys just following? You just observers? Tell me your name.
Ellie.
Hey, Ellie. How are you? Where are you from? Okay. It happens, you know. You're in Israel now. You may escape, yes. Yes, Ellie.
So, I was wondering, why is we see that many places in the Torah it kind of puts on a pedestal the idea of, like, Melech HaMashiach, and in general, like, the kingship, the Malchus of Israel, but when you look in, you know, the Parakim in Shmuel, when it talks about when this idea of a Jewish king first came to fruition, that it was clearly not recommended and not, you know, the lechatchila way of going. So how do we kind of settle these two seemingly contradicting ideas?
Mm-hmm. Again, a good but not a terribly new question. The question is really, if the Torah said, Som Tosim Alecho Melech, why was Shmuel so affronted when what it seems to be is the hope that we would, you know, the fulfillment of a mitzvah in the Torah, right? That essentially is your question. And, you know, I will give an answer that will get me in trouble on all of these tape recorders. And that is that motivation really counts. And that there are many ways. Gemara in Sanhedrin says the Torah can be a sam hachayim and a sam hamavis. And applied in the wrong spirit, there is much in the Torah that can be turned into something ugly. Right? Because in addition to the compliance with the mitzvos, they have to be done within the context of Kedoshim Tiyu Ki Kadosh Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof. It is not enough to do righteous things. Righteous things must be done righteously. And Shmuel apparently took the measure of the spirit of the nation and concluded that they were using the Torah as a kind of an implement, that it was a convenient time for them to yell they were doing a mitzvah. But the motivations for this particular moment were somewhat impure. This, by the way, is the elemental corruption of politicians. Politicians always declare that they are acting in the name of values when they are really acting in the name of interests. And there is nothing more disgusting than hearing some politician announce how he's pushing a bill because it's going to bring jobs and it's going to bring prosperity. And then you find out that the industry that he's mouthpiecing for, an industry which has been totally reckless and irresponsible in terms of the good of its workers, the environment, take your choice, is bankrolling all of his work. And they use him as the voice of virtue to cover the work of vice. In those moments, it is the role of the Navi to say, you will dare not invoke the highest aspirations in the name of the lowest conspiracies. So obviously Shmuel was smelling the politics. Does that make sense? Is that okay, Ellie? Does that answer your question? You do have the right to say, I don't know what you're talking about, or I disagree. I don't want you to, I'm not, this is no, there's no Das Torah. Yes. Well, Tosfos talks about different levels of Shelo Lishma. Because there are certain things, Shelo Lishma, better not to be born. There is, in other words, Shelo Lishma means that you're not doing it with the full positive intent, is one thing. Shelo Lishma with a cynical negative intent, when you're using it for your own purposes, as for example, when a person is trying to gain illicit influence by presenting himself as a Torah scholar. And that's what he's learning for. He's learning so he can acquire personal selfish power. That's when, that is not the Shelo Lishma which is validated. So essentially your question is really dealt with by, Tosfos had exactly the same question. Good shot. That there are levels of what it means should be Shelo Lishma. Obviously, in this case, Shmuel saw it as the more pathological version of that phenomenon. Yes. How would I advise that we relate to non-Orthodox or non-observant Jews on a personal and a communal level? I have to say that my general construct, and so, you know, this will either, you know, make my case or be its fallacy. My general construct of the world today is that more pernicious than the issue of the belief in God or in the belief in Torah, more pernicious is people's sense that God does not believe in them. I think there are people who feel deeply unloved by God. So, I'll give you an example, and here's another, not to go out of this room, How many of these little buggers we got up here anyway? But too bad, because I'm not sitting at that table, so I don't need an opinion. You know that in England, jolly old, there's been an ongoing raging debate about whether the Orthodox community should or shouldn't participate in the Limut Conference. Right? I assume that that is something, I don't think you have that in mind, but that is a perfect, God forbid. That would be an example of the kind of question you're asking, right? So, am I a Navi or what? No, what? Up to now, the assumption was there's sort of this, bilateral possibilities. A, go. B, don't go. Right? So the policy of the former chief rabbi, Lord Sachs, was more or less don't go, although I think some individuals went anyway. And the new chief rabbi, Rabbi Mervis, wonderful gentleman, has, I think, taken the position that it's okay to go. Honestly, I don't think either of those positions is the best answer. Because what's going to happen now that the chief has said go? So the rabbis who lean to the left will now go with a clean conscience, and the rabbis who lean to the right will not go because they don't want to go anyway, right? Because their feeling is we should stick with our policy and for whatever, and I don't want to discuss the politics of it. However, in terms of the tactics of it, I think there's a third possibility which would be much better. That would be that all of the Orthodox rabbis should be gathered together, and as a group, they should select whatever it is, 5 or 10, however many slots there are, the best 5 or 10 guys to go to Limud, representing all of them. Which 5 or 10 guys would you send? So, I'll tell you the two possibilities that are both wrong. A, you could send the 5 or 10 real frum guys. Because, like, they won't give an inch, you know. They will go and tell those people, Eitz Chaim hi, l'machazikim bo, the Torah demands perfect fidelity. And no one should expect that the Torah will exert its protective force over Klal Yisrael unless they are wholly, wholly devoted and determined to maximize its obedient. Right? That's one possibility. Second possibility is send in the libs. Oh, we love you. We respect all points of view. No matter what you think, we think you're wonderful. We represent a traditional point of view. It's true. It's our opinion. But we love you all. Now, unfortunately, that... God, am I going to be in trouble when this goes out? That is almost an incipient apologetic. You know who I would send in? Which 5 or 10? I would find the 5 or 10 rabbis who have the best senses of humor. I'm serious. And who don't take themselves as individuals too seriously. And who will present the Torah in a way that feels human, but without budging one inch on authenticity. And let the people know that it's not about gaiva. And let the people know that we believe that the Ribbono Shel Olam loves them. And because we love them, that we enjoy being with you. We love being with you, laughing with you, even laughing at ourselves a little bit with you. Anybody seen this? I don't know if you've seen this guy on YouTube. There's this like frum guy, yeshivish guy, who does these routines, and he talks about his hat and all this kind of... Do you know this guy? Anybody know the name? What's his name? Mendy Pellin? I don't know. My son shows me these things. I have no idea what I'm looking at. What? This guy is an Avos Yisrael love bomb. Because he talks about what it is to be a Haredi Jew in the most human, and I really don't think, I mean, maybe some would disagree with me, he is not self-hating. He is not out there like some kind of a prostitute selling out what he represents. He's just human. And he talks about, you know, his hat and why he loves his hat and why he only has one color suit and so he never has trouble shopping for clothes. I mean, yes, it's brilliant. It's just brilliant. But the man, I just wanted to send him the Jewish Nobel Peace Prize. Because all the people who were so afraid of Haredim that they've, even in the modern Orthodox world, to our shame, they've turned it into some kind of an epithet. It's like the worst thing you can call somebody. What he's revealed is we're just folks. We don't think we're better than everybody in the world. We're doing the best we can because we're trying to serve God in what we believe is what he asks of us. But we haven't lost our sense of humor, and we haven't lost our interest in talking to you, even if it means explaining ourselves to you. If they would send 10 funny rabbis to Limud, they would take the hearts of Anglo-Jewry back. Because even the people who came there, who were associated with Masorti and Reform and whatever it is, or secular completely, they would say, you know, I went to Limud. It's the most amazing thing in the world. We met these 10 young rabbis, not necessarily young, these 10 rabbis, and they were so human. They were just happy to be there with us. They were happy to teach us Torah. And they weren't stuck up at all. And they looked us in the eye, and they treated us like brothers and sisters. That would win Limud. And it would win it without having to say one negative word or disrespectful word about anybody else. And without apologizing. Because you know what? Moshe Emes v'Sarasa Emes. I'm sorry to boil it down to that in a subjective world. But in a world where everybody says their opinion is one of 50 possible right opinions and no one really... You know what? Ad kana kofa aleph. We're not right because we're smarter. We're right because we have Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah, period. We believe it's true. That doesn't mean you treat people who don't think that way with disrespect. You don't have to, you know, make bonfires on their lawn. But for yourself, you have to know that this is Emes, period. And it's a complex Emes. And it's an Emes which you will only understand on the other end of V'taher Libeinu La'ovdecha Be'emes. Because it takes a very pure heart to find the Emes even in Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah. But, nevertheless, we are in the Emes business. So, you have to know that before you go apologizing to everybody for being from... I don't remember what the question was. Oh, yeah, it was. You asked me about how to deal with... I think if... In our dealings with non-observant Jews, we manifest just that perfect sweet combination of self-confidence and a humility of warmth. I think not only would we make friends, we would make friends for the Torah. And people who in their lives never thought about coming toward the Torah would reconsider. That's my opinion. Yes?
Hi.
Tell me your name.
Ariel Felsen.
I just want to make sure. Felsen?
Yeah.
And what's your father's name?
Michael.
Yeah. And your...
My grandparents.
Your grandparents are the Zlotniks.
Yeah.
Two of the most wonderful people in the world. His grandfather knows more about Mishnayos than anybody since Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi himself. And even there's a little question. His grandfather may know more. It's a long yarn.
So to continue on what you're just saying, how would you recommend to someone who's learning yeshiva and they want to learn at a very intense level, and very seriously, but at the same time kind of retain their personality and their humor. How would you recommend on the one end being very intense in the learning and still continuing to be able to kind of be like a normal kid with a sense of humor and not lose his personality?
First of all, a lot of Torah is very funny. What do I mean? I don't mean, you know. No, I do. When we learn the sugya, I have a shir. I have this game, we call it the Great American Torah Novel. Great American Torah Novel is about making up stories to explain the hechitimtzos of the Gemara, which are sometimes difficult to understand. You know, they sound wild. So, what, like, for example, when we learn the sugya of Gezel HaGer, this has to do with a ger, and he has no yorshim. So I made up this guy Pierre, the ger who had no heir. And then I decided, just added to it, he was also bald. So he was Pierre, the ger who had no hair and no heir. So, but what was funny was, we learned this sugya. And we described, you know, we learned the whole sugya as if it were events in the life of Pierre. And we had a great time with him. He sort of brought the whole Gemara to life. What was interesting, now you have to understand, this is a shir for just regular Balabatim every morning at 6 o'clock a.m., right? So guys are really, it's early in the morning, and there's no particular avenue for chazara and things like that. So we learned this sugya. Maybe 8 or 9 months later, in the next Masechta already, there was a brief mention in the Gemara of Gezel HaGer and the whole, just a reference to that sugya. So the guys in the shir went, oh, Pierre, the ger who had no heir. They were so excited to be back with him. And there's no way, like, they would remember this, you know, stamazoi. So that the notion of humor is a gap closer, right? Humor is something that lets people know they don't have to be afraid about a big distance. They don't have to hold something way, way far from them. And lets them bring it closer and hold on to it. So first thing, you can always find a way to bring light and a little bit of laughter into the Gemara. It doesn't mean the Gemara is a joke. It means the humor just brings it, makes it something you can hold, something you can touch. Second, there is almost nothing in the world that is not funny. And most of those things you have to engage anyway. So, I mean, what is the world's oldest source of endless mirth? Yeshiva food. You can't eat it all the time, but you can always joke about it. Right? So, I mean, when we were in yeshiva, there was nothing to do with this food except jokes. You certainly couldn't eat it, God knows, unless you wanted to die on the spot. But we made gentle jokes about it. You know, it was fun. We turned, life was fun. And part of what that is, you know why people don't make more jokes? Because when you joke, you're vulnerable. If you say something that you think is funny and it dies like a lead balloon, there is nothing like watching the Hindenburg crash and burn in your very presence. And it's your Hindenburg. Right? So, and there are always a few people, their idea of a good time, because they can't make jokes, is killing somebody else's. So my brothers did this to me my whole childhood. I was like 40 before I realized I was actually funny. Because my brothers were always saying, that's not funny. My one brother especially would be, no points. I said, like, what Bulgarian died and made you the judge of the Olympics? Where did he get to be the scorekeeper? You know? But there are people like, and oh my gosh, when I started in Riverdale, See, when Riverdale hired me, it was such a mekach tos. First of all, I was much too young for that. They should all be sent away for child abuse. I was so young. And beside that, they looked, you know, I had one of these fake resumes with all the doodads on it. Oh, he graduated from here and he got this thing and that thing and that thing. It never occurred to them that I might be funny. So the first couple of years, I would say something from the Bima, which I frankly thought was hysterical. And I had like a group of four yekis sitting like three rows back. And I would say something funny. It was like Iron Dome is nothing compared to the plexiglass wall against which these humor bombs fell. And they would sit there and they would go, I think the rabbi just made a joke. The next one would say, and I thought it was in very bad taste. And the other one go, I agree with you, I didn't get it either. So I just felt terrible. So for years, like, I crawled inside myself and just, you know, tried to be serious. But I couldn't do it. So I had a few guys sit in front of the yekis. Gave them laughing gas I borrowed from a dentist just to make sure. And now, but you see, I have certain cues. Like, sometimes when I'm in the middle of a really killer drasha, you know, like one of those really serious ones, the kind they sleep through, you know, I'm in the middle of a really thing. Sometimes I'll be standing at the Bima. This is true, but and if you meet a Riverdale at that time, I'll be standing at the Bima. And you know, you don't need words to make a drasha. I'm serious. Let me illustrate. You think I'm kidding. They think I'm kidding. Listen to a drasha with no words. Why is it all? In a personal poem, we are some. And also, poor does your body, it is your worst. What can I say? I am sorry, I'm not saying this on the other one. It is in your body. Oh, but there's so much I say. And it's so high, and there's so many others. Hey, there's shading! And June! And I'm telling him, I be as I go along, right? So all the words rabbis are putting in, it's just because they can't figure out how to make those sounds. So they have to find some words. You know what I'm saying? So when I've got it really ratcheted up, sometimes I'll go, oh my God, I just thought of this story. I can't resist. And I stand by this, and I'll just tell him like some story that just flew into my head like a joke, like for no reason, or a little stand-up just about something that occurred to me that just struck me funny. And I will just, they know already when I go into a certain voice. It's like my kids know. When I start to say something, they'll go, this is going to be a joke. Like when you have to have people announce that for you, that's pretty pathetic.
Joke coming. Okay, everybody get ready. You won't be able to tell because it's not going to be funny, but it's a joke.
So they got, like, it took a while to break them in. And so that's, I don't remember what we were talking about. Honest and good. Oh, you were asking about being normal. This is normal. should pardon my expression. They have hospitals for this kind of normal. But what happens when I meant, going back to the vulnerability, when you tell a joke, you're saying, I'm putting myself out there. You're basically telling the people you're with, I trust you, not to humiliate me, not to leave me open. Nothing sadder. When anyone expresses some kind of emotion, it's like if you're in a shul, right, with a chazan, and the chazan is emotional in his davening, and you can hear the weeping in his voice, you know, and some guy in the back row says, what the hell is wrong with the chazan? Did his wife again buy him shoes two sizes too short? You know, what's he crying about? That just, that kind of scalding cynicism means that the man has opened himself up and he's just been, someone just took him down. There's nothing worse than making yourself vulnerable and then being rejected. And that's why humor is both so powerful and so precious, because it means that you have established an atmosphere where you're making yourself vulnerable, which says to the other person, I trust you and I feel close to you. That's why it's especially important. If you're a serious guy, which I'm sure you are, because your father was a very serious guy in BMT, I remember that. If you're a serious guy, remember that the guys around you who may not be as serious, they all feel a little guilty that they don't put the same hours in the base majors that you do. Right. They all feel a little distance. They assume you're judging them. When you come to lunch and you open your heart with some jokes, you're saying to them, I'm not holding myself away from you. I don't think like I'm God's gift to the world because I spend a little more time in the base medrash. I'm to be lucky. I have a gift. I have good concentration. I know that there are guys who spend half the time in the base medrash, but the time they spend costs them more energy than it costs you. Because I can tell you, anyone who has had any kind of issues with reading or concentration and things like that, for that guy to put in a solid hour, there are guys who can put in 3 hours at less cost. So this is not a numbers game. You come to the table, you sit on the bus, you go out, you know, you walk with somebody to get some pizza, and you open up and be a little funny. You're saying, I trust you to be close. Because I love you. We're the same. It's no big deal. And that has great... I don't think it's just a matter of power. I think it has great holiness. Because that's the kind of thing that creates the love in a Beis Medrash, for example, that makes it possible for that guy to come to you and say, you know, you really... I think it's amazing how much you learn. Do you think maybe you could find half an hour to learn with me? Why? Because you're normal. Why are you normal? Because you open your heart up. And in that base medrash, there will be love. Worst thing in the world is morbidity. Hasidus is full of mamorim about the danger of atzfus. Atzfus doesn't just mean personal depression. It means a kind of a creeping, contagious bitterness that can move from one to the other. It carries with it all the bad cancers, suspicion and jealousy and disdain, all that bad stuff. So if you can manage to chase all the atzfus out of a Beis Medrash, people would learn like they were singing. It would be amazing. Yes. Any other questions? And Sadiq, what's your name?
Uzi.
Nice to know you, Uzi. From where?
London.
Sweet. Where in London, can I ask? You're right.
I know you're biased, but do you think that there's a future for the modern Orthodox communities outside of Israel?
I'm kind of hoping there'll be a present. Yes. Because I believe optimism is a sacrament. Do I think that we're in a great place? Not especially, because I think we're missing some key ingredients and, to a certain extent, missing leadership. But I absolutely believe there's a future. Because, you know what? We've been counted out before. There was a time when I first met the Rav. He once said to me, if you had asked me in the 60s, I would have told you that I thought we were the last generation of Orthodoxy, that conservatism was rolling over us everywhere. If you asked me, did I predict a future? He said, I never would have predicted it. He said, I would never abandon the Masorah, but I had no idea how it could possibly continue and prosper. He says, well, the Rabbon Shalom works in mysterious ways. But the only way a modern Orthodoxy will prosper if it develops itself into something which is worth believing in l'chadchila. If it's going to be a lazy, accommodationist, pallid compromise, then it doesn't deserve to live. It has to be a real something and not a way station for people who are on their way in or their way out of Yiddishkeit. So the answer is yes, I do. You don't mind if I don't know if I get some guys who I haven't met yet? Yes, Tariq. What's your name?
Noah.
Noah. Do you have a last name or?
Yeah, Ramos.
Whoa. From who's your dad, Alan?
Yeah.
I know your father, I know your mother, I know your grandparents, I know everybody. So very nice family. I know your Jonah's your brother?
Yeah, Jonah's my
brother. Jonah's your brother. He's a sweetheart. I love that guy. He's very good. So you're probably all right also.
What?
You're probably okay.
Trying to be.
Good. Best answer. Yes, sir. See, I got him too.
Why do you think that all the bracha that you say, why is the bracha of Shelo Asan Yesha written in the negative?
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about Shelo Asani Goy? What about Shelo Asani Ovid? I mean, it's not the only one.
I just feel like that's the question which everybody asks. I think the other ones should also be asked as well. But.
Ooh, tough guy. Can I tell you my honest opinion off the record? Not halacha lemaisa. First of all, as I understand the bracha, the Ikar Adin, the series needs to be understood together. The advantage that men have is that they have more explicit direction in Avodas Hashem. There is less left to a kind of a personal fashioning. Right? The Avodas Hashem of a woman is, in that sense, much less specifically regulated and more regulated toward the production of results. Right? Toward process that is judged by its product. Right? And that's tough. And most men couldn't handle it. Now, that being said, I don't want to sound merely like an apologist. Frankly, in terms of the recitation of that bracha in synagogues, I don't think in daily prayer generally women were present. I think that we might want to consider, and again, this has to come from poskim. I'm not saying this is a posek. I'm just saying as someone thinking that there may be certain things which we need to consider in the light of kavod habrios, of who is in the room when we say them. So, for example, 25 years ago, although I must say I was on the other side of this 25 years ago, I'm not embarrassed to say, 25 years ago, it was not uncommon for Orthodox rabbis to speak about the issue of homosexuality in the most savage terms. I mean, really, why? The assumption was, this is not about anybody we know. You know, it was a kind of a safe whipping boy. The minute rabbis began to realize that they were probably talking to people in that room, when they began to realize that if they weren't talking to people in that room, they were talking to people in that room who had children who were struggling with sexual identity, the whole tone of the rhetoric changed. Why? Because when someone is in the room, you speak to them differently than the way you speak about them when you imagine you're talking about someone on the planet Mars. Right? So the rhetoric of the pulpit in your standard mainstream Orthodox synagogue has changed. And it doesn't mean they've changed what's written in Sefer Vayikra. They haven't changed basic halachic things, but the sense of sensitivity for the people in the room has changed the rhetoric. I believe that particularly in synagogues, where more and more women are coming to daven during the week, where more and more women are coming to say Kaddish, we might want to consider having the bracha of Shelo Asani Isha or Shelo Asani Kiritsono recited by everyone silently. Certainly it's an ancient matbea shel tefillah. I think for people to say it is still, certainly necessary. But just out of kavod habrios, nothing else. Not a kind of a sop to any, a feminist issue. But because there are now people in the room, there is a new reality, that maybe we would consider reciting it quietly so that I shouldn't have to ask a woman to say amen to the chazan's bracha shelo asani isha. Right? And I think that category of kavod habrios, the idea of not making things part of public declaration, I think that would go a long way towards making the shuls feel like we are aware of who's in the room. I'll give you a mashal a mahadavar doma. Now when you come to the first day of Rosh Hashanah, Hashem pokad es saro kasher amar, it would be very, very easy to gather a host of Ma'amari Chazal which talk about just how terrible it is to be childless, the terrible heartbreak of barrenness. Now, if you're a Rav in that shul and you're choosing the words of your drasha, and you know that in your shul you have two couples later in life who for whatever reason were never blessed with children, and they are wonderful people, and they go to everybody's simcha, and they don't live in a sense of bitterness or jealousy, what human being in his right mind is going to go on and on in the sermon digging into the crack in their hearts? You'll find a way to darshan with different language, with a different emphasis. Why? Are you saying it's not part of Torah? You're saying that those Mamari Chazal should be expunged? No. They don't need to be expunged, but they need to be used with compassion. And sometimes compassion means to take the accent off, to take the spotlight off of something which is going to hurt or insult someone who is part of your tzibur. I think we've become more and more conscious that, that there are people in our tzibur, in our family, who have special sensitivities. I think we are blessed that more and more women want to be part of the tzibur for daily prayer. And I think to be sensitive to the who is in the room factor is a kind of policy which doesn't affront the halacha, it doesn't affront the matbea shel tefillah, but but it just reminds us that we also have to be human. Yes, my dear. Yes. I should probably know, but you could tell me your name if you want.
Daniel.
My mother, Allah Shalom, never let me talk to strangers, so I'm very careful. Yes, Daniel.
At least for the Shemabet, so we've been having a dating marriage series. And
a series of dating or a series of marriages?
No
wonder people like to come back to Shana Bet. Come back to you, you get a new Rebbe and a series of marriages. Yes.
A point that's been driven pretty often is the importance of being able to listen. Do you have any tips on how to be a better listener?
Don't talk as much. Well, one tip is helpful. While the other person is talking, don't spend all your time thinking about what you're going to say next. Because it's much better to be listening. And people really like follow-up questions. And people really like to know that you remember things that they said and mention them later. Right? Those are just easy, easy tips. Also, if a person says something that you think is particularly important to them, it's a trick we use sometimes in therapy, but it works in conversation too. Say it back to them in other words. Saying, that's really interesting. So you're saying that, blah, 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 to let them know that you really want to understand it. Not like, okay, next. You know the story about the guy at the cocktail party, don't you? Says, well, that's enough about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think of me? Yes, Kayla. Okay, so you gotta make sure that someone else is really feels interesting, and as they feel your interest. And these are some little techniques. Even if they're boring you to tears, this will work. Just kidding. Yes, Leo.
Similar question I've asked before. How do we interact with friends that are openly violating halacha?
Very gently. We're in a really, one of the most difficult challenges of our period is that once upon a time, and this is absolute human nature, especially in Jewish communities, the way they're constructed, people take their cues from their peers. Right? So you sort of, as you're growing up, you figure out who are the guys who are like you, who are like your chevra. You know, they're not crazy from, they're not crazy wild. They were the guys that I consider to be sort of on my page. And then all of a sudden, 2 years after high school, like you meet a guy you've known since kindergarten, a guy you used to go for Shabbos play dates to, a guy whose parents are friends with your parents, and you have that horrible meeting where you bump into him on the subway or on campus, and he's not wearing a yarmulke, which is not in and of itself, you know, the worst thing in the world. He may, for example, if he's a Syrian, the most religious Syrians often didn't wear kippot, people who were very medoctic. Yekis, as a group, were very medoctic to wear their yarmulkes when they ate, but didn't wear it in the street, etc. So, barring that, but a guy who always wore a yarmulke, because he was regular, and you meet him, and he's not wearing his yarmulke, and you have that sinking feeling. Somewhere you just know, I think he's not in the program anymore. You just sort of feel it. Now, whatever you're feeling, you can guarantee that he's feeling it three times as much and is feeling a sense of awkwardness and embarrassment in your eyes. If he means anything to you, the sooner you can get together, the sooner you can let him know that he doesn't have to lie to you, he can be honest with you, and that you will be happy to have him as your friend. You share so much. I mean, my kids had best friends as little kids. Very interesting, who were so good to them, and their families were so good to them. And their paths diverged. They just turned into very different kinds of people. Sets of friends with almost no intersections, right? But it is so interesting that when there's trouble, when one of them needs something, either one would fly to the other one's side in a heartbeat and have his back. Why? Because what they share, you can't erase. The sooner you can let those friends, if you really care about them, if they're significant friends, the sooner you can let them know that you can't go back in your life and make a new best friend for your 8-year-old self. You can't do that. And that you, the two of you, are holding pieces of each other's past that are absolutely beyond value. And that you need to hold on to each other at some level. But it has to be honesty. You want that guy to be able to tell you, at least, like, don't feel you ever have to lie to me. And I won't lie to you. You know, I'm not gonna tell you that I can go everywhere you go. I can't eat everywhere you eat. I can't go to the parties you go to. But we'll find something to do together. And very often, you go back to old business. Like if the two of you love to shoot basketball, find a time to shoot some hoops. If you love to bowl, find a time to go bowling. Go back to something that's still neutral, that's still in the parts of your circles of life that still can overlap. And as I said before, if he knows that you're from, he knows what that means. And he's essentially proud of you. But he will love you. He will love you, and by extension, he will love the Torah that you represent because you still make a place for him. So there's some very, very powerful good medicine available in those situations. Did we dry them up? Did you have... Yes, boss.
We had like in Gemara that they had incorrect science back in the day, so just so you don't pass them by certain things because the Gemarim didn't have the proper scientific understanding at the time. Why can't you apply that same idea to maybe social interactions that halacha maybe 1500 years ago was different than it is now, and the rabbis made certain halachas based on what they had at the time, but now it's a totally different way of going about it.
It is much more delicate process. Why? Because, let's take an example. When it comes to certain kinds of scientific knowledge, such as, microbiology, the understanding of microscopic germs and things of that nature. It is not too hard to demonstrate that we can keep people from dying of things that they died from before. When it comes to social norms, you have to be much more delicate, because very often modern society has replaced things that worked with things that don't. We are in a terrible skid in terms of gender relations, marriage, parenting, extended versus truncated family. I mean, we're in a real skid, and it is not taking us anyplace good. This is not something which is making for happy campers. So to willy-nilly assume that because something is contemporary, it is therefore superior, is something which is very, very tricky. Mitzad sheni, it is very likely that to a limited extent, we do that. In the sense that our job is to maintain concepts like Kedusha and Snius and fidelity, etc. The big tickets. The exact methods by which we protect those things may need some adjustment in order specifically to protect them. So for example, if all of the examples in the Gemara are from a Mediterranean climate, when Jews go to live in Norway, you cannot bring over what's called the realia. You can't simply assume that everyone in Norway is going to wear the same sandals in 5 feet of snow that the Gemara describes. What you need then to do is to try to abstract what are the qualities of life that the Gemara is building on, and to use a certain amount of imagination to make sure that those qualities... See, because one of the things we've gotten in trouble with is we've become sort of obsessed with little details. Like, so we have, like, the obsession with wearing yarmulkes. Obsession with wearing yarmulkes means that in certain places, people who are living disgustingly dissolute lives wear yarmulkes. Right? Because to take off your yarmulke is to change your social group. Right? The fact that you're sleeping around, you know, well, that, no one ever told you not to do that. They just told you not to take your yarmulke off. Well, obviously someone's missed the boat. Because what they've done is they've substituted something which was supposed to be a symbol for a whole complex of attitudes and behaviors, and they've sort of taken the cherry off and replaced the ice cream with melted tar. And tar with a cherry on top is still tar. Because you have to ask yourself, do we still have the substance of Yirat Shamayim? The substance of Avodas Hashem. So, you know, it's really a tricky thing, Avi, to... You have to really always be asking hard questions. That's why I say, you know, I mentioned it before, but if they had only said "V'tahir li beinu le'ovdecha," just let us serve. It's when they put that word on be'emes that it got heavy. Because be'emes means you have to ask yourself, is this still be'emes? When you see what goes on, I don't want to get into my pet tirade. The kind of bacchanalia which are being held with glatt kosher hashgachas. You go to some of the catered affairs. You see what people are shelling out huge money for. Like, what makes you think that is l'shem shamayim? You go to weddings. You go to weddings that cost like $500,000, $1 million. And people, you know, they've got enough lamb chops to basically, if you could put them back together again, you could have herds and herds of sheep. Because that's not treif. What makes it not immoral when people are out there hungry? Which doesn't mean you can't have loveliness. You can have a lovely affair. But at some point, it's just an exaggeration that goes to the point of immorality. The most beautiful thing in the world is a wealthy family that chooses to act with restraint. That is the biggest act of tzedakah in the world. Because you know what? All of a sudden there's a matir for all the poor schnooks who are trying to keep up to slow it down and cut it back. Oh, Mr. So-and-so, the guy's got more money than God. And did you see what he served at his daughter's wedding? It was very nice. There weren't five choices. He actually served chicken. I thought that bird had become extinct. When's the last time you saw a Jewish chicken affair? People think you serve chicken. Oh, chicken's what you send to a shiva house. A wedding with chicken. Did you know the kedushin could be chal on chicken? I'll tell you the truth. I thought they were living in sin. I figured at least prime rib. They want to be married really d'oraisa, you know. Hadron mina hadron, better be a veal chop at least. If that guy, that rich guy, would serve chicken nicely and would say, this was the nicest, I loved my daughter's wedding, I loved my son's wedding, it was lovely. And how many pieces do you need in the orchestra? I mean, I know there are achronim who say you need a minion under the chuppah. You really need a minion under the drums? 20-piece orchestras. Rachmana litzlan, why? Why? Three guests left with their hearing impaired. We obviously didn't have enough musicians. Should have been 50 people leaving with their hearing impaired. And that is what's called menuvel birshus haTorah. That's what's called missing the be'emes. The balance, the balabatishkeit. Balabatishkeit means to do something nicely, but with a measure of restraint. And, you know, that without, you're worried about, you know, making changes in the social norms of the Torah. I'm worried about making changes in the social norms that we have come to accept as normal, which are totally perverse. Just to come on, I feel bad because I know some people have late Seder and some people have Seder with their pillow. So I don't want to keep people prisoner. Wouldn't you? Tell me.
Yeah, so over the summer I learned like
I still don't know your name. According to my mother, this conversation has not happened.
Gavi Nelson.
Say again?
Gavi Nelson.
Okay, Gavi, nice to know you.
Where
are you from? Where are you from?
New York.
I've heard of that.
Sierra.
Okay, good.
Over the summer I learned the Rambam about Carbono, how he says like when Mashiach comes, we'll have like, I'm not sure, I don't know exactly, but how do we like reconcile that by saying that he says like he probably won't eat meat like without, out of the context of Carbono, was like today when we, like, should we be changing into that kind of ideal or like context of...
Okay, once again, I'm going to say something that these machines are going to make me regret. I think possibly within 20 to 25 years, the vast majority of Orthodox Jews are going to be vegetarians. I think we are the last generation of meat eaters. I don't know what's going to be with fish, honestly. But there are two factors in my thinking. One, we are learning more and more about the capacity of animals to suffer psychologically. The data of animals like elephants that continue to suffer for trauma that happened to them early in their lives. What cattle go through when their children are taken from them, etc. What animals instinctively fear is their fate when they're being taken to slaughter. I think, that's very nice, thank you. I believe that there is going to come a point where, I mean, you talk about upgrading scientific knowledge, obviously. I think the standards that we apply to Tzar Balei Chaim may have to change. We just know too much. And to recognize the sensitivity of other creatures. I mean, the Rambam actually, the Rambam discuss, when you know, there's a big discussion about how to understand Shiloh HaKein. You know, sending away the mother bird. The Rambam says in Moreh Nevuchim, and the Ramban actually quotes him and says that the suffering of a mother animal is absolutely no different from the suffering of a human mother. Now, is this true that animals are not considered balei dea? But at the level of their capacity to suffer, there is a commonality. And the problem there is not the objective suffering that we inflict. It is the problem that we know what that suffering is, and if we inflict it, it changes who we are. The level of cruelty, if you really, really knew how an animal suffered, if you really knew it, could you really enjoy a steak? You know, you're worried about cannibalism. Could you really enjoy a steak knowing that it was the part of a creature that died in psychological agony, let alone physical agony? Second thing is, from a purely scientific point of view, we now know that certain kinds of viruses, for example, jump from species to species. Modern agriculture is largely based on large groups of animals which are genetically very similar to one another, being raised often very close to human habitation. We've already had a few little samples of what happens when things from an animal population jump into a human population and can cause great, great suffering. So you had SARS and bird flu and cow disease, and there's even a theory that AIDS came into the human population through monkeys which were eaten as bushmeat in Africa. So different species each have their own unique sicknesses and things like that. And when you're talking about a huge population, when we had things that when the bird flu hit various places, they had to slaughter literally millions of birds because every single one was a threat. I think it's just not going to make sense from an epidemiological point of view to have those kinds of giant concentrations that it takes to feed a burgeoning human population, and that essentially are being raised in factories. Because that's the only way to do it at that scale. I just don't see it. And frankly, you know, and I know everyone thinks it's anti-Semitism, the European countries that want to ban Shechita. I'm not sure if it wouldn't be a bigger Kiddush Hashem for us to give up Shechita before it's banned. I think it would be pretty sad if people coming with scientific evidence of the nature of an animal suffering come and make us give up Shechita because they care more about the animal suffering than we do. I think that would be possibly a Chilul Hashem. So I know, you know, I'll probably get torn to pieces for that, but the one thing I try to do when I come here is tell you guys the truth as I see it. It's not Das Torah. I'm not a Navi, and I'm not a big Talmud Chacham. I'm just a poor guy trying to find out what Hashem wants from us. Yes, Tani.
Jacob Siegel.
Say again.
Jacob
Siegel. Hello, Jacob Siegel. From where? All right. Is that Rabbi Weinstein territory? One of my favorite rabbis. I love that guy. Okay.
But deciding between YU or non-secular college and a secular college, where does one draw the line between Yishtablut and, you know, believing that Hashem will take care of you?
Does President Joel know that he's giving out protection? That's good. Jacob, honestly, I wish to God I understood your question.
I'll rephrase it.
Okay.
Meaning, if Hashem is going to take care of you anyway, why not just go to YU and learn Torah and be in a safe Jewish environment than go to a secular college that you think might put you in a better situation?
Ah, so you're talking about the question of the advantages that a secular college might give you vis-a-vis your earning capacity. Right? Well, that's a fine question. The only problem with it is it's premised on a kind of a platform of greed, which insists that, have you ever noticed that we're wasting a lot of people's time when we say the Rosh Chodesh benching? Like when we get to that part where it says Chaim Shel Parnosa. Like, why are we bothering with Chaim Shel Parnosa when all anyone cares about is Osher V'chavod? Parnosa means enough to support your family respectfully, right? But guys don't go in it for that. Guys want rich. And if the guys don't want rich, there's a good chance that the girls who want the guys want rich. And there are a lot of guys who told me over the years that if they're going into a profession which is not, you know, a big earning profession, there are some girls who are just not interested in going out with them. I'll never the mothers who call me, we want a liner and an einer. Right? Even if it means coming in at 2 a.m. every night, you know, during those terrible years when you're struggling to make partner, or where you have to get up because the markets in Japan are open. What the hell do I care about the markets in Japan? What am I going to do with Japanese yogurt anyway? Time it gets here, probably be sour. The markets open in Japan. Yaha! Buy me some sushi and call me in the morning. But look, I don't think those are dishonorable things. I do think that when you go to plan your life, be very careful what you ask for. Because when you go straight to Osher V'chavod and skip over Chaim Shel Parnasa, you are going to pay for it. In some currency. You're going to pay for it in the time you have to spend with your wife and your children. You're going to pay for it in terms of the time you have to learn. People who work that hard, no one's given away big bucks for nothing. And there really is a quid pro quo. And if I hear anybody tell me, but Rabbi, day school tuition, I'm so tired of hearing that. You know, we need day school tuition, therefore we need 3 cars in the driveway. Therefore, every time somebody sneezes, we have to have a catered simcha. You know, you see that I don't want to say the name of a caterer. You see that fancy catering truck in the driveway of a house? That's like a visit from the Malach HaMavis. Somebody had to work a long time to pay for that corned beef. No, I don't want to take business away from the caterers, but at what cost? At what cost? And you know what? When you've dedicated your life to big money, it's true, you may get a chance to give some good tzedakah, and the people who can do it and keep balanced, tova aleihem bracha. I know some very remarkable people who've been successful in that way. I think it is a dangerous prescription for the Amcha. And it's more dangerous when you don't feel you have an option. Your job is to support your family. You want the formula for wealth? You can write this down. You can write it and have it duplicated and send it to yourself every day as an automatic text message. You want to feel wealthy? Need less. Because a heck of a lot of people in the world are not happy even though they have a lot. You know why? Because they don't have what they think they need. If you get to the point where you need a Maserati, then you may not be poor, but you're needy. Oh, I just can't be happy with this. I can't be happy unless... I mean, you see people living in perfectly nice houses. Everyone's got enough room to do what they want. There's even enough backyard to build a sukkah, go out in the sun in the summer, throw around the ball. And then you see them, all of a sudden, they have to, they despise that house, and they sell it, and they buy something that looks like a stable for Barnum and Bailey's elephants, with rooms they don't even know what they're going to do with. Why? What made them despise the happiness that they had in that house which they actually could afford? You know, Samech b'chelko means the capacity to create joyfulness in your portion. That is a more valuable skill than anything you can learn at the fanciest university. The skill of making joy. And you want to... So what happens? People buy big houses, right? And then they live under a lot of pressure. You know, they work. So what do they need? What do they need to anesthetize themselves from all this pressure? They need to buy toys for themselves. They need stuff. Now, the problem with stuff as an anesthesia is it wears off very quickly. So what do you need when you go back to feeling bad? You need some more stuff. That's why you can buy things online, so you can get the stuff real quick. What happens to all this stuff? You see, it's very tricky. This stuff comes to live in your house. The stuff which is no longer effective and is anesthetic, it just then becomes stuff. After a while, your house becomes stuffed with stuff, which means you can't really move around. Which means you can't find things when you need them. Which means your house has a general sense of chaos about it. Because you thought you had this stuff, then you realize the stuff's got you. Then you discover, Craigslist notwithstanding, that hardly anybody wants your stuff. You thought it was such great stuff. And then you try to unload it. And you realize you can't even give away your stuff. Because nobody wants your stuff, because they're busy buying their own stuff. Now here you are with all this stuff, but you don't want to throw it away because you paid good money for this stuff. So you tell me, where is, you know why there's no Simcha Bechelko? Because there's no room for it. Because there's all this stuff. You compare that to a person who lives in a, you ever been in the home of someone who's like got it under control? And it can be a relatively small home, but everything has a place. The people in it look neat. Everything serves some purpose or has been very, very, very carefully chosen for its loveliness. And when you have a picture on the wall that you really like, you stop shopping for more pictures. Because after you get more pictures, sooner or later you're going to want to buy a new wall. And in that house where everything is tidy, when you're the guest, you walk into that house, you immediately begin, the Chinese call it feng shui, the sense of kind of like happiness, good luck, harmony. On the other hand, you walk into a big house, but it's a mess. Because, like, there's no place for things. Like, you know, there's stuff all over the place. Like, the bookshelves are stuffed. And you know what your friends do when you invite them for Shabbos? Guess what they bring you? Stuff. Oh, I thought you'd love this stuff. I brought it for you. You bring another piece of stuff in my house, I'm going to lay you out. I don't want any more stuff. I have all the stuff I need, and if I need it, I'll get my own stuff. So the best thing to bring is like flowers, because you know when they're rotten. You bring a guy a book he doesn't want to read, that thing's going to live forever. sooner or later, they're going to pack that up when he's dead, and someone's going to get a hernia schlepping it out to the garbage. So, Jake, you probably thought I forgot your question. God forbid. The answer is, before you pose that question, you figure out, you know, and I'm a big YU fan, you figure out what it is you go to YU to get. Because I'm sorry to say, and this is not a knock on YU. YU is not an automatic slam dunk. You go to YU, you better go knowing, because if you get the best that YU has, you have the best anywhere. But you can stumble through YU and come out with nothing too. You have to work, right? You ask yourself, what do you really need? What do you want for your life? How much value do you place on the things that YU at its best gives you? And if to purchase those things you have to sacrifice maybe the difference between comfortable and rich, cut your best deal. Buy yourself happiness for your chelik. Yes, boss.
Yeah, a lot of people in yeshiva kind of become the designated rabbis for all their friends who don't want to find a real rabbi.
Could you remind me of your name again?
Brody Schlesinger.
Okay, that sounds right. Yeah?
Yeah, a lot of people become kind of designated rabbis for a group of friends who find it easier to ask a friend a question than find a real rabbi to ask a question. Mm-hmm. What extent, what are you allowed to answer them based on your knowledge of halacha lemaaseh, or however great or small it is, and what is kind of off limits that you have to say, whether I know the answer or not, it's not my position to say anything.
I don't know exactly what you might be referring to, but my basic thing is, if you know the correct answer, give it. I'm again, here I go, I'm going to get nailed again. This fetish with rabbis to me is far, far, far out of bounds already. It's the fetish with rabbis which has bought us a whole generation of Chilul Hashem. I introduce myself to people these days, I'm afraid to say I'm a rabbi. If you know the right answer, like, you share anything. Share the right answer. It's a chesed. Most questions that people ask are not that hard. If you feel that it's something which requires either more information that you don't have or judgment, I'd be more careful about the things that people get mess up other people is when they give them glib opinions which have nothing to do with halacha. Halacha, at least you have an objective standard. You know, if somebody calls and asks you if they should pull the plug on their grandmother, maybe you want to get a consult. Someone calls you if they should divorce their wife, maybe you should send them for professional help. If someone calls you and asks you, is a certain hashkocha reliable, and you happen to have checked it out, there's a date. You know, buy the marinara sauce. Am I missing something in your question that's more subtle than what I responded to?
No, there's always this fear that, I mean, how much did I know last year that I realized it's wrong this year? So I'm going to realize next year that everything I know.
Well, in that case, keep a list of the people you answered. Call back and say, oh, I don't know how to break this to you, but your kitchen's trafe. I'll help you kasha your pots. Don't give that information unless you're pretty sure it's correct. And to tell you the truth, you know, I have one of those sheepskins on my wall. I've said things I had to retract. You're human. Give the best you can with the humility to know when you're not really in a position. But if you think you know the right answer, it's reasonable, it came from a good source, you learned it, you asked someone reliable and they gave you the same answer, I don't think you have to add layers of self-doubt just for the sake of having layers. Okay? I think maybe like one more. To you didn't talk yet. What's your name? What's your name?
Shua Brick.
Okay.
We had a chance now to speak to some of your day and had a Q&A setting like this. Amital, your salvation, a couple of questions are bothering you that you want to ask them.
Deep. Very deep. Very, very deep. You know what? In the latter years, I was very, very close to Rav Mital. I didn't have that relationship with the Rav, so I have no idea. In his later years, Rav Mital didn't talk much. But he listened so beautifully. I think what I miss more than anything else, because over the years I spoke to Rav Mital enough and I have a sense of what he would say. I don't miss what he would say, and I don't have like three questions, you know, I forgot to ask him. But for his listening, I feel like an orphan. I don't have anyone whose listening means to me as much as Rav Mital's. And all he had to do was listen. And if I said something that ran counter to his sensibilities, which were as finely tuned as you could imagine, I would just see it in his eyes for a fraction of a second. And I would know I needed to make an adjustment. When things are hard, when I'm feeling beaten and sometimes almost broken, I would do anything just to have him to listen for a little bit. Because I think ultimately, that's what the great shepherds do. More than they give information or answers or whatever, put their arms around you and let you know that you're not the last stop on the train and that you still have someone you can go to pour your heart out. I'll tell you honestly, since he died, I don't have anybody. And sometimes it really hurts, but then I think, you know, Rav Mital came to Israel after all of his Rabbeim had been murdered. And for almost 60 years, he listened to all of us. So I was lucky. I had him until I was, you know, well into my 50s. And so, you know, to whatever limited extent, I'm, believe me, far from Rav Mital and not in any way fit to carry on what he was. But to the extent that I can do some listening, I just hope I'll have the Yiras Shamayim and the Avos Yisrael to be the listening orphan, you know, for some other people for as long as I have. So I don't have any questions. Gentlemen, I will try to remain conscious as long as anybody, as I can be helpful if anybody needs to talk. And truth of the matter is, I'm just looking around the room and I am